of the Genesis narrative. He looked at the people that existed within the historicity as people that actually existed. He talked about Abel, Abel being a person who was a real person in history. We looked at Paul's writings, and Paul looks at these events that happened in history, and he looks at them as something that is historical, not as something that is a myth. And he uses these historical truths as a foundation for certain theological points that he makes. And we looked at aspects of the book of Romans and some of these parts that just don't make any sense if there wasn't an Adam. If there's not an Adam, if Adam was just a myth, how is it that we therefore go forward and say that Christ is the second Adam? Because we believe that Christ was a real person. We believe that the work that Christ did actually influenced and affected all of these other people. So how is it that we could say over here that Adam is someone who existed but did not affect these other people, but yet Christ came to deal with the sin of Adam that affected so many other people? It makes absolutely no sense. The most reasonable way to read what Paul writes is to understand that there was a historical Adam, that Adam fell, and the consequences of his sin affected many people. And Christ came as the second Adam, the one who fulfilled that which the first Adam had fallen short in, and that which he did influenced those that came after him. Today, I want to deal with just a bit of clearing the table so that we can walk through Genesis and science, and I want to deal with certain assumptions that exist in our society, that there's, you can have faith or you can have reason, right? You can have religion or you can have science. And I want to make an argument that you can't really have science apart from God. It's not going to make any sense at all if you try to understand science apart from God. You may be able to understand science. There may be people who are scientists that don't even believe in God, but they have no basis for the belief that they have in science. They're going to have to, as we have said before, they're going to have to steal from other worldviews in order to make what they do work, in order to be somewhat consistent in what they're doing. But they end up being inconsistent because they have no worldview to support the perspective that they're coming from. So I want to deal with the predominant views that rule in our society, which is that of naturalism and that of, the word would be positivism. And positivism isn't formally given that name so oftentimes, but it's the idea that you can only know something to be true if it can be proven scientifically. In both of these worldviews, I want to demonstrate, are inconsistent and are self-contradictory. And I believe in looking at these, it'll help us as we move forward. Here's a quote from G.K. Chesterton, and he says this: "If my children wake up on Christmas morning and have someone to thank for putting candy in their stockings, have I no one to thank for putting 2 feet in mine?" And just he's oftentimes really good with words, and he was a journalist that did a good job making points such as this, where there's a child who might receive something, regardless of your views on Christmas, but a child who received a gift on Christmas knows that someone had put the gift there, but yet someone else, maybe even someone who had put that gift might in themselves claim to be an atheist, might claim that there is no God, that everything came from absolutely nothing, and through a series of catastrophic events, through a series of time and chance, everything came to be that which it is. And that person will deny that they had someone to thank for putting 2 feet even in their own socks. It is in many ways a self-contradictory statement. As we walk through this, I want to talk through presuppositions. And presuppositions are the aspects of what we believe that we don't prove, but rather they are supported in what we believe. And apart from them, you can't really go anywhere. You can't really do anything. And so the ones that we'll deal with here in naturalism, and that of, we'll also call it empiricism, that scientificism or positivism. And the naturalism would give the statement, it would say, only that which is natural is true. So if it's not made of matter, it doesn't matter. And so that the belief is that only that which is material is that which is real. And the empiricism would argue that only that which can be observed, what can be verified through observation, is that which is the way in which we should determine that which is true. And both of these, we're going to demonstrate, are going to fall short just in the premises that they make. But what I want you to see is what we walk through when we walk through presuppositional apologetics is that merely giving evidence is not sufficient. People don't have a problem merely just of knowledge. It's not just that they don't have enough information and we merely need to just give them information. We're going to talk about using evidence. We're going to talk about how we argue aspects of the existence of God, but we want to do it in such a way that we don't put the person that we're talking to as someone who's sitting on the judgment seat, as the person who just gets to take down all these notes and decide for themselves whether or not there's sufficient evidence to determine whether or not there is a God. That is foolishness. And first I want to deal with this aspect of the myth of neutrality. There's no such thing as neutral ground. If you begin to engage with someone, if you begin to talk with someone who's coming from a naturalistic viewpoint, and you begin to say, okay, we're going to dismiss Scripture, we're going to dismiss the existence of God, we're going to set these things aside here, and then we're going to stand over here, and we'll have a conversation, and I'll prove to you why either Scripture or God is true. What you've already done is you've eliminated any basis you have for proving either God or Scripture are true. There's no such thing as a neutral ground. There is, and if you want a great place where this is demonstrated, Greg Bahnsen in his debate with Gordon Stein dealt with this. And if you listen to nothing else of that debate, I would encourage you just to listen to the introduction. Just in that first 15 minutes, he completely knocks the legs off of the argument that Stein is standing on, and he really never catches up in that debate. And this is what he points out. He points out that Dr. Stein has no basis for that which he is standing on, that which he is arguing. As soon as you begin to make an argument, you have no basis even for making that argument if you are standing on a foundation that says there is no God. Psalm 14:1 says this. It says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is no one that does good." So if the Bible says that the fool says that there is no God, does it make any sense that we would seek to stand in a position of so-called neutrality regarding the existence of God? Does it make sense that we would stand there and say, okay, I'm going to stand over here as though I have a blank slate, a blank mind, and I'm going to prove that there is a God, meanwhile taking a position that would be one in which you start by saying that there is not a God? When I make an argument here, I want to go back to Jesus, because many of these ways in which people seek to criticize the Genesis narrative, many of the ways in which people seek to take away from the authority of this narrative takes away from the authority of Christ. And I want to point this out as well. We did that last week. Let's look at it this week. Let's look at some ways in which Jesus did not believe in this so-called neutral ground. Matthew 12 and verse 30, "Whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters." There's not a middle place here. You don't have a place with Christ where you can be somewhat in the middle, just a free thinker, just trying to work this out and think this out. You're either with Christ or you are against Christ. We need to begin with certain premises, such as man's problem is greater than just having a lack of knowledge. It's not just that he needs some information. It's not as though man is just this this just needs someone who needs just a little more information to help him here, and then he would fully understand this. Sometimes we do need more information, but in relation to knowledge of the existence of God, we do know that there is a God, and the scriptures make that point. But I want to look at Romans 8, verses 7 and 8 first, which says this: "For the mind set on the flesh is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God." We look at this, I want us to see that the problem of humanity is just greater than them just needing some knowledge. The problem is not one that's primarily intellectual. It's not something that they just need to figure out. We can look at some of the most brilliant people in history and see some of the most terrible actions, some of the most evil actions that have ever happened. Some very brilliant people, great people in the area of tactics, have used their ability in this area to massacre many people. Some people that are very knowledgeable in the area of science have used their knowledge in the area of science to just create and do just incredible atrocities. So our problem is not just with knowledge. We have a problem with our minds. We have a problem with our emotions. We have a problem with our desires. We don't naturally think right, even when we get the information. Just having the information doesn't solve the problem, because sinful man, when he gets the information, will distort and contort the information to please his sinful heart. We have a problem in our innermost being, and that's what needs to be dealt with. Sometimes as Christians, we'll fall into this trap. We'll think that, well, we just need more knowledge in this certain area. As a pastor, I will work with and talk with people at times that maybe they're struggling in some area of their marriage, or maybe they're struggling in some area, and they will go and do something that basically, you know, knocks the train off of the tracks, and they will come to you and they say, look, we just need to sit down with someone. We just need to sit down with a counselor. They're going to sit down and someone with a lot of experience, and that person will just give us this information. And it can be very helpful. Counselors can be incredibly helpful. But the problem is not just information. The problem, so oftentimes, is that there's a problem in the heart, that your heart is desiring to do that which is destructive to your marriage. And you're continuing to do these things, and just getting information doesn't solve that. The heart is what has to be dealt with. Paul talks about the mindset on the flesh, and he says, doesn't give you a middle ground here. It says the mindset on the flesh is hostile toward God, right? It doesn't submit to the law of God. It cannot. So those that are in the flesh cannot please God. The other side of it is the mind that is set on the Spirit. The mindset on the Spirit is life and peace. There's not a neutral ground here. There's not a place where you sit right in the middle. That's not the wording that Paul gives us. James 4:4 says this: "You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of God, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world, makes himself an enemy of God." And in our conversations with people who come from an unchristian worldview, we need to fight the temptation to be a friend of the world. You need to fight the temptation to disregard the Christian worldview, to disregard the foundation upon which you stand, and then operate from a position of naturalism or just one of empiricism. And then go try to work backwards to God, because in doing that, you have eliminated your ability to ultimately point to God, and you've eliminated your ability even to rightly argue within the positions either of empiricism or naturalism. So just to review on presuppositional apologetics, we want to remember from the study that we did many years ago that we stated, apart from a knowledge of God, you can't really know anything. Non-Christians will use aspects of the Christian worldview, but they'll use them in an inconsistent way, because it's not possible within these non-Christian worldviews to have a consistent belief. Look at Romans 1, 18 through 21. Paul writes, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So to take a so-called neutral ground position is to stand in contrast to what Paul is writing here. Because Paul says here, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. And he goes on to say that they are without excuse. So we do not want to take a so-called neutral ground position, because the idea of some type of a neutrality is a lie. It's not something that is true. But in this conversation, as you will have a conversation with someone, I have seen some that misunderstand this idea of presuppositional apologetics. And their idea of what this is that we just merely repeat to someone that they are a liar and a God hater. And I've had friends that I've worked with, and that is the pathway that they've took. So they begin to engage with someone, and it continually goes back to, well, you are a liar and a God hater. That is absolutely true, but the best way to communicate that to someone is not always just directly making those sentences. So within presuppositional apologetics, what you're doing is you may use evidence, you may use argumentation, but what you're doing in making this argumentation and using this evidence is you're making an argument to show the inconsistency of the view that the person has. I'm not using this evidence to try to put them on the seat of the judge and to let them just make their own determination so they can put all the evidence together and then they can judge God whether or not he exists. What I'm doing is I'm showing them that what they hold to, the way they act, the way they live, the way they orchestrate the lives of themselves and their families and the way society works cannot be understood in any of these non-Christian world views. So you do use evidence, but you use it in a certain way. And I'm going to try to show you at the end, if we have time. If not, we'll do it at the beginning of the next one, some ways in which you can walk through some of these various arguments, and you can do so in a way that points to the ways the non-Christian worldviews show their inconsistency. So just a few points that I've been trying to make, that there is no one that is neutral. No one. There's no such thing as neutral ground. You're either with Christ or you're against Christ. Those are the two places you can be in. Secondly, everyone knows that there is a God. We demonstrated that from Romans 1. Thirdly, everyone knows that they are violating the law of God. Everyone knows that there is a law. Everyone knows that it is wrong to steal. The biggest evidence that they know that it is wrong to steal is how the person behaves when someone steals from them. They're going to be inconsistent in how they operate under the law of God. No one exists without any law whatsoever. But what we do as sinful human beings is that we desire to be God ourselves, and we want to determine, well, in this little sphere of authority here, I get to determine how law should work out. But over here, other people should operate in this way. So we know that we're violating a law. And one of the evidences that I point to there is the fact that whenever someone does the same thing to us, we get offended. Whenever someone, even a thief, you know, even a car thief, if he's going out and stealing cars, he knows that it's wrong. And the evidence that he knows is wrong is that whenever someone tries to steal his car, he's going to want there to be some kind of justice. He doesn't want it to be like, well, you know, whatever. You know, truth is relative. Whoever takes my car, it's not a big deal. They do care. It is a big deal to them. And so fourthly, I want to point out, we pointed out that the Christian worldview is the only worldview that can consistently interact with reality, and that is the truth. So when we use evidence, we want to do it in such a way that honors God. We want to be God-honoring with our use of evidence. I understand that in evangelism, you may start with some kind of a packaged format, and I'm not completely against using a package format, but as you grow, I would hope that you become, it just becomes more natural for you to have these conversations with people, and you're not having to work off such a script. But I think there's much that we can learn about how to interact with people through the conversations that Jesus had. And I want to walk through some of those. And I want us to look at this idea of using evidence to show the inconsistency with someone else's belief or someone else's worldview, to show that you, and what you're doing is you're basically doing this. You're saying, okay, you say this is true here, and then you're going over here and you're saying, but over here you say this, and you're trying to show the inconsistency between these two views, that it's just not reasonable that the two things that are there, and then you, what you're doing then is you're pointing them to Christ. Let's look at Luke 14, 1 through 6. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of the ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully, and behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox who has fallen into a well on the Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. So these leaders here had a false view on the Sabbath, which was inconsistent with the world around them, and it was inconsistent with what they already knew to be true about the Sabbath. They had a problem with Jesus healing on the Sabbath. We see that in many other scriptures. But Jesus points them to another area where they would have been okay with doing some kind of work on the Sabbath. They would have been okay with helping their own son. They would have been okay with going and taking their ox out of a ditch. But yet with this man here, they're using an inconsistent view in how they're understanding the Sabbath. So what Jesus is doing here is he's saying, you're saying this is wrong, but when you look over here, you operate in these ways here. You're taking knowledge that people already know to be true, and you're taking the knowledge they already know to be true and showing them how they're being inconsistent in this false view. Let me show you another one. This is an interesting one, but I thought I would use it. And this is a passage that there was a time where I was like, wow, what is Paul doing? How does he hermeneutically do what he's doing here? And I believe I understand what he's doing at this point. But 1 Timothy 5, 17 and 18. And I believe Paul uses the same line of reasoning here. He says, "Let the elders who rule be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the preaching and the teaching. For Scripture says, 'You shall not muzzle an ox when he treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages.'" I was sitting in a seminary class and one time, and I had a professor who said that Paul was allowed to use this style of hermeneutics because he was an apostle, and we should not use this type of hermeneutics whenever we're interpreting Scripture. And now, granted, I thought I shouldn't just randomly grab a passage out of the law and seek to apply it. But I really had a problem with that. I was like, why is it that Paul gets a special hermeneutics and the rest of us don't get one? Why is it that Paul knew that this is a special passage and he could use it this way, and you know, the rest of us just aren't privy to this knowledge? But I believe that Paul here is making an argument in the same way that Jesus did. He is showing someone who has a false view in this area here, and then he's taking information that they already know to be true, and he's showing them, if you know this to be true, then that's evidence that you already know this over here to be true. And he's trying to link the two together. And it basically works like this. If it is wrong to muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, right? If it's wrong to treat an animal in that way, if you already know that this is under the law how you were supposed to treat an animal that was working for you, why is it that you would treat a person worse than you would an ox? Is the man not of more value than the ox? This is an important way of communicating with people. It gives you a lot of opportunity to talk with someone else, and it gives you opportunity to kind of deal with difficult areas. So let's look at another one. One more. Matthew 25, 15 through 22. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his talk and sent their disciples to him along with their Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said to them, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought it to him, a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar's the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And when they heard it, they marveled, and they left him, and they went away. See, in this conversation, they tried to trick Jesus, and they were trying to pin him here. They were either going to pin him against Caesar, and they were going to say, "See, you say not to pay taxes." And so now they could use Caesar against him, and they could bring the Roman authorities in. Or what they could do here is, if he said that they should pay the tax, then they could argue that, look, you're against the Jews, because the Roman taxes were extremely unpopular to the Jews at this time. But what Jesus did was demonstrate the foolishness of them even asking him this question in the first place. I mean, how is it they could argue that Caesar doesn't have the authority to make them pay when they are using a coin with Caesar's image on it? See, they are already demonstrating the legitimacy of this in the fact that even had the coin on them. That's what Jesus is pointing out to. And so this is what we want to do here, is when we're talking with people, is we want to demonstrate this inconsistency. You have someone who is made in the image of God. Their very existence points to God. Their very existence is evidence of God. And we have such a person there that is breathing the air that God gave them, eating the food, living life in so many ways, and which point to the work of God, and yet they're denying God. And so the mere fact that someone who is made in the image of God would make such an argument is to show the foolishness of such an argument. Let's walk through naturalism and empiricism. So problems with naturalism. This is something that if you go to college, you're going to run into this worldview of naturalism. It is the way that most of the sciences are taught. They're not consistently taught this way. You can't consistently teach this way. But naturalism is the belief that all that exists is that which is natural. And what happens within this naturalistic worldview is that you say, well, only that which is natural is true. And there's many aspects of life which are going to be completely removed. How is it that you account for experience? How is it that you account for laws? How is it that you account for morality? And there's many other areas in which it is not consistent within itself, but yet the people that are going to tell you that all that is real is natural are going to be people that still work in these other areas, but yet they have no basis for it, because there's many areas in their life that they work in that don't work merely under a naturalistic mindset. Let's look at this idea of positivism or empiricism, and this idea is that only that which can be known can only be known through empirical study. So only that which is worth knowing, or that which you can know for sure, is only that which you can prove from a scientific perspective. And this is a point that falls apart immediately. I mean, if you were to make that statement that the only knowledge that you can know for sure is that which you can prove scientifically, you've just made a statement that you can't prove scientifically. How would you go and prove that? How would you go through the scientific method and prove such a thing? One scientist and preacher named John Polkinghorne makes a statement. He said the scientist might be able to show that water is boiling because the temperature undergoes a phase and a transition from water to vapor, but they can't show why the water is boiling. So in the one way, they could show it's boiling over here because I slaughtered this. I'm sorry. I slaughtered this. So through this empiricism, you could prove why the water is boiling physically. It's boiling physically because the temperature has reached 100 degrees Celsius, and that's causing it to boil, all right? But it can't prove, you can't prove scientifically that the water is boiling because I wanted to make a cup of hot tea. See, that is a true statement. Is the water boiling because I wanted to make a hot, cup of hot tea? Yes, I put the water in the kettle, I turned on the stove, the water is boiling. But you can't, that's not something that can be proved scientifically. Let's walk through a few of these. I want us to think through just a few things in these last couple minutes, because this took longer than I thought it was going to take, of things that you can't demonstrate through science. What are some things that we can't account for in science? The first that we talked about is science itself. Science itself is based on assumptions that can't be proven scientifically. So we can't prove these assumptions of empiricism merely by going through an empirical method. What about things like math? How is it that I prove math scientifically? Science uses math, it presupposes math, but how is it that I could prove math scientifically? How do I prove that there is such a thing as a three? We can put threes on the board. That doesn't prove that there's a three. That is a digit. That is a symbol of a three. And so long before anyone knew anything about science, there was still this concept that existed, which is that idea of math, that idea of a three. Physical laws. Let's think of physical laws that exist within the universe. Look at a quote from Richard Dawkins. He says this. It's a very uplifting and positive quote. He says, "In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." And I have an author that responds to that, an author named Swice, in his book, 10 Blind Spots of Science. He says this, "But he did not arrive at that conclusion that there is no purpose or good or evil on science alone. No, he assumed that based on his atheistic point of view, which he has not proved. Science gives us physical truths, but not the ability to interpret them for us. We do this in using our ideas and our ideologies." And we saw Dawkins even there, he makes the statement as though it's blind science, blind naturalism, but yet even within that, he couldn't even make this argument that he makes merely from a scientific perspective. Another thing that science can't prove, science can't account for, laws of logic, the idea that non-contradiction, the idea that two things can't be contrary in the same way at the same time. It's not possible. You can't have something that is a square circle. Laws of logic are something that are not natural. They're not something that you can, they're not made of matter, but they're something that do exist and they're consistent in all places. Ethics and morality. How can I prove that something is right or wrong using science? How can science prove that the Holocaust was wrong? Some try to do this, some walk through this from a utilitarian perspective, which means they look at something and they say, okay, how is it that this does the greatest good for the most people? But even that ends up not being ends up not being something that is argued from science, but rather ends up being argued from a philosophy, which is utilitarianism, which is that which does gives the most benefit to the most people at that time is something that is the most right. But even still, we know that is not right. Suppose that killing 20% of a population would result in a better life for 80%. Would we argue that that is something that is true? But even still, you can't come to that through arguing in science. Conscious truths. Science can't tell you what experience is like. Someone will say, I don't believe anything that is non-physical. Well, you're making a non-physical statement. You're proposing an idea. That is something that is not within the material realm. Alvin Plantinga, a former professor at the University of Notre Dame, argues for the non-physical nature of intentionality and mental conduct, and he does this, and he asks someone to think of their mother, and he says this: we can examine neural events as carefully as we please. We can measure the number of neurons it contains, their connections, their rates of fire, the strength of the electronic impulses involved, the potential across the synapses, with as much precision as you could possibly desire. We can consider its electrochemical, neurophysiological properties in the most exquisite detail, but nowhere here will we find so much as a hint of the content of your mother. It's not something that is a physical idea. It's not something that just exists within the physical realm. What about aesthetics? Can science prove beauty? We can learn about what type of paint that Van Gogh used, but can science prove that it is something that is beautiful? Can we use science to show that the Lord of the Rings trilogy is superior to the Chronicles of Narnia? You can't. But yet people who would exist within a naturalistic mindset will make such statements regularly in their life. It's something that they're going to say. They're truths that they're going to regularly speak. And the problem is that they can't account for them within that worldview. Science or faith? This is a quote we used. It might have been last week, and I stole it off of a White Horse Inn podcast from a couple weeks ago, but he says this. He says, the opposite of reason is not belief. The opposite of reason is irrationality. The opposite of belief is unbelief. Therefore, you can have a reasonable belief, or you can have a irrational unbelief. So this idea of it's either faith or reason is false. Science is not either you believe in science or you believe in religion. This is a problem that many people run into. Does science lead to unbelief? This author Swice makes this point. He says, the problem is not science, but naturalism or materialism in science. It has held many hostages in its ideological cage. And this is the problem, is that many working into this are coming from this naturalistic perspective, and that is what leads to this. It is not something that you have to hold to in order to hold to science.